before we start the podcast, I'm at this again. First of all, if you're a patron, you don't need to hear this. You can get the consolidated RSS feed, and from there, these aren't included. So you can just listen to the podcasts as they're done, as they come out. If you aren't a member, if you haven't joined us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, you've already missed some gems this week alone. I know it's only Tuesday, but you've already missed a brand new police. It's really good. Dr. Gardine McAvoy joins Vicky to talk about Irish speakers and how they're dealt with in the criminal justice system. Then we have myself and Martin, as you're probably aware, have decamped to Derry to talk to people around the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And we sat down in the Museum of Free Derry with none other but the Derry girl herself, Aoife Grace Moore. And she tells us about her insights as a member of a family, a Bloody Sunday family, as she puts it herself. And on top of that, we just put out a podcast with a member of the Ukrainian parliament, a member of the opposition, Lesia Vasilenko, which, really impressive woman. She gave us what's going on the ground from her point of view, her perspective, the people she represents, what her wish list is, and how she sees a route out of this. And not only that, but not only do you speak to a member of the opposition, we're scheduled to speak to a member of the government in Ukraine shortly. And that will go out on the Patreon feed as soon as I can put it together. All of these are available at the click of a button for the price of what's cheaper than a pint these days. So if you could just join us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, you wouldn't have to hear me plead with you, and you get them as I can get as quickly as I can produce them. Thanks for your support. Enjoy the podcast with John Schwartz. I just can't give it over that he keeps coming back to these podcasts with these two idiots from Dublin. Thanks, John. And thanks to everybody for listening. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves. And today we're back talking to our friend in the US, journalist, reporter and writer with the Intercept, John Schwartz. Martin, you've been looking forward to this for a while now.
I have, yeah. First time I get to talk about this with somebody.
It's funny because, no, we get to talk about it. I just don't like listening to you. but John, first of all, thanks for coming back on the pod. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, no, it is great to be here, and it's great to be talking about Don't Look Up.
Yeah, and we will talk. Don't look up. But before we do, John,
we finish this podcast, I'll be also calling you directly so you can hear my thoughts even more detail than I'm going to be giving them to you now.
Before we go there, what's the temperature like there, John?
Yes, well, politically speaking, the temperature is like even more bizarre than it has been in the United States before now. Like, I keep on thinking that America has reached the most bizarre level possible, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. It's really extremely strange. And, I'm glad to say that everyone in my family is fine in terms of the latest coronavirus variant, but just seeing how the country is dealing with it overall does not give me a great deal of faith in the future when we try to deal with things that are even more difficult.
You know, the U.S. has actually, it's funny, internationally, some of the soundings from the U.S., particularly from Joe Biden, have been more to the left than the EU, particularly when it comes to, you know, things like the TRIPS waiver on vaccines and vaccinating the developing world, to use that awful phrase that we peddle out. Yet, you know, vaccine hesitancy or skepticism has been a big problem, John. And a public health expert I know said that Omicron was the gift we bought ourselves because, you know, we allow the virus to circulate in parts of the world and we bring it back. Will we call the next variant the Florida guy variant or anything like that, maybe?
Yeah, we very well may. I would say this about Joe Biden. This is important to keep in mind. The EU has been terrible like on this issue about getting the world vaccinated. Biden has been slightly better, raising his level to merely awful, because he's said some good things. His administration has said some good things. Their actions have not matched their words by any means. And we've actually done some coverage of that. And it's really dispiriting to see, not just because it is morally wrong, but also because it's unbelievably stupid. Like, as you say, like as you were discussing with the public health expert, like the longer that there are variants, the longer that the virus is anywhere, the more variants there are going to be. And we're just rolling the dice over and over and over again. We're very lucky this time to get one that was contagious. That was bad, but the fact that it doesn't seem to be killing as many people, you know, that's not anything but luck.
I 100% agree with you on this. We've seen that, and they have. They, sometimes they'll say it's better to be lucky than good, but I'd rather we hedged our bets there. I've one question just on the actual overall picture. You know, we're looking at the Dems, the Republicans. We're still hearing that Donald Trump is apparently the betting man's favorite to be president again. And there's already talk that within 12 months now, because if they lose the midterms, that Joe Biden might be a lame duck president within the next 12 months. It does seem, and I suppose that's the worst case scenario. Is that where you feel that the on the finger of the pulse where it's going, or am I just being overly pessimistic?
You may not be being pessimistic enough. I think that, God, you know, honestly, I've sort of given up trying to predict where American politics is headed. You know, I certainly did not imagine that Donald Trump was ever going to be president of the United States. And so once that happened, I was like, well, I really don't understand very much about this at all. So who knows what may happen? But the Democrats have a very, very slim majority in the House of Representatives. And that's partially due to gerrymandering, partially due to them not being a very competent political party. And they very easily could lose the House. And the first thing that the Republicans are going to do if they take control of the House is impeach Joe Biden. Ted Cruz even mentioned this and said that, like, it's going to happen and it doesn't really matter whether there's a reason to do it or not, whether there's a legitimate reason to do it or not. And so it's a little perplexing to me, the lack of urgency on the part of the Democrats here. But that's the Democratic Party for you.
There are, Martin, we spoke about this. There are people saying, oh, well, there could be within 5 years, we could have an actual effectively a civil war in the U.S. in many regards. And we all sort of shrug and we all sort of say, but this stuff can happen. Like, we can sleepwalk into it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my I think the saving grace of the United States is that we are too old and too fat to have a civil war. Like, we're too old, too tired. You know, we have a lot of guns. Like, we have that part down. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
But I think that just generally, you know, America, like, as a country, is older than, you know, the EU in general is also pretty old.
Yep.
And probably older than the United States. But on a world scale, like, we're a pretty old country. The median age is pretty high. And you need a lot of, like, young, energetic people to really get a civil war going. And so my hope is that that will not happen. And I can easily imagine a lot of, like, sort of sporadic, weird, intermittent political violence, which is no joke and no fun. But hopefully we're not going to be, like, suiting up in the blue and the gray again, which you may remember were the colors of our original Civil War.
Yeah, I have to go with you on that, John. I think it would be very hard to motivate enough of those fit young people. There's just too many distractions. There's just, you know, we can't fight when we have to, you know, Insta. We just can't. Yeah,
that's exactly right. You know, the first wave of soldiers will go over the top and then they'll all be posing.
But I just want to come back to the vaccines just for a moment. And it's something I've been thinking for a while, is that what the West has done with the vaccines is, rather than use them as a solution to COVID, they're using them as a life raft for the wealthy. And that's really where it's all gone wrong.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, seeing what has happened has been one of the most depressing experiences of my life politically, because this is a situation where, like the moral case and also just the case for, like, keeping yourself safe in the long run are the same. You know, it is as though the people running the United States do not understand that diseases are contagious. And, like, as we've seen with this variant, like, you can get vaccinated and then you can get it again. Like, even though you can get not again, you can get it for the first time, even though you're vaccinated. And so I would have thought that they would have understood that and realized that, like, nobody is safe unless everyone is safe. Apparently they don't.
That's going to bring us on to the subject matter. But I want to mention the piece you wrote yesterday on The Intercept, and it is about inflation, which I discussed on the Sunday show briefly, Martin, you'll recall. And you were talking, but also you were framing it through the prism of social security. And I don't know if you noticed, John, because I was looking at how you broke down the economics of it and how, you know, without that social safety net, there are literally millions of Americans who would fall into poverty overnight, and the private market would not step in, and that all of it. We have a situation here in Ireland. I don't know if you've noticed, because you know everybody said, "Oh, the new global minimum tax rate might have impacts on Ireland and all." Yeah, it did actually. It turned out we had our biggest year ever on corporation tax receipts, where to the point where I think it was nine companies made up nearly 50% of our total tax take, which leaves us very vulnerable to what's been framed as footloose capital. But we've also, in that time, been paying out supports to people who we told to stay home because of lockdowns, and it didn't even make a dent on those figures because we had the money coming in. How, and I know stimulus packages and everything, they were saying, you know, inflation is transitory, don't worry about it. But it is starting to bite now in the US as a cost of living issue.
It is. And, you know, I would say that the thing about inflation generally, like under normal circumstances, is that the cure for inflation, even if inflation is fairly bad, is generally speaking like worse than the disease, because the tools that the government has are generally like those of the Federal Reserve, which are to bludgeon the economy, raise interest rates until the economy slows down. And so fewer people have the money to spend on things, and there's less demand, and then prices fall. So generally speaking, like high inflation occurs at times of like really low employment. And it's better for people to have at least sort of moderate inflation and really low employment than to have less inflation and high employment. And hopefully we'll be able to find a middle way that the coronavirus will recede. That will by itself, I think, reduce a lot of the inflationary pressures. And then inflation will fall, you know, to some regular modest degree, and unemployment will remain low. It's a situation where the people who run the United States freak out about inflation. I wrote something about this before, actually, and it got on Fox News because they were so mad about it, pointing out that that if you are a debtor, if you have student loans, if you have a mortgage, inflation is good for you. It reduces your debt burden, and inflation is extremely bad for the people who are the creditors, you know, who are the banks loaning you the money, and hence the people who own the banks. And so there's nothing they hate more than inflation. Like they totally lose their minds about inflation. High unemployment, like that's perfectly fine. Like if nobody has a job, that's okay, as long as inflation stays low. And so they went crazy. It was really kind of peculiar to see them get that angry about me pointing that out. But anyway, the point is just that like inflation is, it's a tough issue, because I don't want to diminish, you know, the way that it can make lives more difficult for people with less money. Like that is true, but you got to be very careful not to solve it by raising unemployment levels.
Yeah. And I think that's Ireland, Ireland actually, again, we looked everything through our own lens, but it famously, we went into the bailout post global financial crisis, and we had a period of austerity, and the narrative still pervades in much of our mainstream media that austerity worked and we got our way out of it. But that is actually a total fallacy economically, because what made a difference is when Jean-Claude Trichet stood up and he said, we'll do whatever it takes to solve the euro, and they'll become the buyer of last resort, which meant Ireland then, because all these loans we'd taken to bail ourselves out at maybe 5-6%, we could then effectively borrow off the EU for 1% and swap our debt, and all of a sudden we were carrying more debt, but our economy was big enough to lift ourselves out of it. And it was, and you know, when you try to explain this to people, they go, even now they go, well, we borrowed like 400 million a month during the peak of COVID. And you're going, yeah, but the economy was delivering gangbusters, so much so, and this is important that listeners notice, that the EU did a recovery fund for COVID. Ireland's economy grew so strongly that we weren't eligible to apply for any money from it, John. Can you imagine, like, in the middle of a global pandemic, we did so well that we weren't even allowed to go in and say we'd like some of that cheap money because we had so much of it awash in our economy.
That really is remarkable. I did not know that story. And I hope there are people writing about it there, because that's something that people really should understand, like both there and in Europe and in the world generally.
Oh, no, I get called a charlatan for pointing it out, but there are economists. But
maybe we can get Fox to find out about you.
Yeah. Look, I know we do want to go there. Martin, I'm going to go to you. You want to, by the way, John's piece will be in the blurb here. I tweeted it out already, but do have a read. I think it's interesting to see the perception of it, and you're quite right pointing out the social security, the net, and how important it is as well. Sorry, Martin, go on.
Yeah, I think we'll start with what you said, John, was that when you look at the current situation with COVID, that it wouldn't give you much hope for the future on the bigger issue, which is climate action. It just can't. And then put into that mix, don't look up. And the reviews it has gotten, to the large part from those who are depicted in it, unfavorably.
It is very funny. A lot of the reviews have seemed as though they are written by characters in Don't Look Up.
Yeah, that is true.
I don't like this movie criticizing me.
Yeah, very much so. And like I have to say, my favorite criticism in the whole thing is the tech bro. That is my favorite criticism.
Yeah, I think that we should just agree that we're going to like totally spoil the movie.
Yes, so absolutely. We've seen it, and I don't think if you haven't seen it, folks, you can switch off, watch it, and then come back and listen to this. Right? Okay. So there's your. We're not going to give you a spoiler free thing. No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. So let's get started and ruin it for anyone who is still listening, yes, who hasn't seen it. I think the tech bro character is one of the funniest things I have seen in a very long time. Like, I think that he is an incredibly like apt updating of Dr. Strangelove, in that like Dr. Strangelove back then was a Cold War scientist, and today he is this tech bro billionaire, but he's not even like what you would immediately imagine as a tech bro billionaire. Like, he's this like peculiar omnipotent baby, like who is so shielded from all consequences in his life that he's like an infant and he has no idea that anything exists beyond him. You know, he's very soft and mushy and vulnerable, and he's able to maintain himself in that state because, you know, he's protected by his immense wealth, but at the same time, he doesn't know that other people exist. So he just goes for what he wants in that immediate moment, and thereby destroys humanity.
Yeah, it is. It's a brilliant picture. And it's also that the overconfidence in a technical solution to problems as well. His utter overconfidence.
Can I ground that for a second in a real piece, Martin, just for, because you I have a picture on my phone of one of these whiteboards, John, that they did at a tech conference where it said, you know, when will we reach net zero? And it was like, you know, 2025, 2030, 2040, and never. Do you remember that this whiteboard,
yeah,
Martin?
Yeah.
And all these tech people were there, and I just started taking pictures to see what it would be like. And everybody was hitting never, weren't they, Martin?
Yeah.
They were literally hitting never.
And only the second most interesting one. Talking.
Yeah, the other one was, they thought, as everybody else. But look, there was no, that governments need to get out of the way, basically, was the second question, you know, about accountability doesn't matter. Company values don't, you know, what about them? Just get out of the way. But nonetheless, you mentioned Dr. Strangelove, and that's similar in how it's been received to how that classic film has been received as well, John. It's right in saying that it had a, you know, I wasn't there when it came out, but reading what I have, it does appear it was met with the same kind of skepticism and stop making me uncomfortable kind of feel.
Yes, well, as it happens, I have right here in front of me a little bit of the review from the New York Times of Dr. Strangelove in 1964. And it is absolutely amazing. Like, it talks, there's a little bit of talking about like these things in the movie are good. Like, there's some funny things and so forth. But then it says, I'm troubled by the feeling, which runs through the film, of discredit and even contempt for our whole defense establishment, when virtually everyone turns up stupid or insane, or what is worse, psychopathic. I want to know what this picture proves.
So yes, absolutely. You could pick that entire phrase up, copy and paste it, and drop it onto the reviews of Don't Look Up.
Yes, you absolutely could. And it's peculiar. And I mean, I don't remember any movie, any recent movie where there's been such a gigantic difference between some of the reviews like that and the like overwhelming like audience response, or like people love it. And you know, as I'm sure you guys have heard, like it's one of the biggest movies in the history of Netflix.
That's being watched, right.
Yeah. Like all over the world by these huge numbers of people.
But the premise, the basic premise that we have the means, we have the capability, we just lack the motivation to actually solve a problem that it's within our capability to solve. And it's that premise that we as we're too greedy, vain, and stupid to do it. And that's really it. And it so strikes home. It's everything I see in politics.
Yeah, we're too greedy, stupid, and vain, and we can't focus on what actually matters for more than 5 seconds. You know, like, okay, we're getting started. And then like what about the celebrity couple has broken up? Oh, no. Like, that's something else that's very funny in the movie. Yeah. And like the head of the whatever it is, the National Planetary Defense Office, like he himself gets caught up and is like, I'm really glad for those kids. Like, it looks like it's working out for them. Like, even as the comet hurtles towards Earth.
It is though. Martin made the point to me, I think last week when we were discussing it, and he said to me that I suppose the question is really for you, John, because he put it to me. And do you think looking at something like Don't Look Up, should every main newspaper have once weekly article that has the headline "We're all going to die"? and outline the reasons for why we're all going to die. And it might be repetitive, but maybe that message could break through, because it's clear that it's, you know, that when you think about it, as we've all referred to earlier in the conversation around coronavirus response, we don't seem to have this within us to make the change that would require a little bit of thinking beyond the 6 inches in front of our face.
Yeah, you know, the thing about this that is so distressing is that, like, there are people in politics who are willing to just say the same thing over and over and over and over again, and, you know, do that, like, be there in people's faces all the time on the same issue. And, you know, that's the corporate right, because they understand communications, they understand advertising, and they know you've got to repeat anything for it to sink in. Whereas I would say in the US media for sure, and I think the media everywhere, everything has to be new. Like it's literally against the rules to cover anything if there's not some like new hook for it. And you can't just be, you know, people say like, well, we covered that already. Like, why would we write about this again? And for sustained problems, you know, that take years or decades to address, like, that is not going to work. And it's the kind of thing where you hear people talking about how, you know, like on TV, we can tell there's, you know, on MSNBC, if you know Chris Hayes here, like he's spoken about how you can just see like the viewership dropping as soon as you begin talking about global warming. And like, you just gotta like throw the idea of immediate profit away. And they don't want to do that. So it's a huge problem.
Yeah, it is. And it's difficult because it is, you know, who drives the story? Does the audience, you know, does the media chase the story for the audience? Does the audience force the media's hands on a story? It's very difficult to know what that balance is. And I've changed my opinion somewhat from should there be an article. I think there should be a wrap, like on a packet of cigarettes, you know,
every issue of the paper. Yeah,
absolutely. You are going to effing die. And then you can up the message as the deadline gets nearer. But I suppose the question is, how do we just accept that this is it? Do we just accept that the world is too vain, greedy, and stupid to do what's in its own best interest?
Well, I would say no, just because if we just accept that, I don't really know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
No, you know what I mean?
And I thought I was the nihilist, Martin, but go on.
Yeah. I mean, like, but it also is a fact, like, as you were just saying, like, we do have the means to fix this problem. And not only do we have the means to do it, but if we were to do it, it would be like one of the greatest sort of political victories, in the sense that we would require people to understand all over the world that we really are living on one planet, and we are all bound to each other in a way that like can't be changed. Like, it doesn't matter. You may know that Martin Luther King once said, like, we don't all have to like each other, but we do have to love each other. Mm. And you know, this is Martin Luther King Day. And that's always a good thing to remember. Like, it's just, we don't have to all think all the other people on the world are fantastic to understand that we are all in this together. And we need to understand that in order to deal with this. And if we could understand that, that would change not just global warming, but a huge number of other issues too, I think. And
Can I come in just on that? It's really important that actually, and again, the film shows it, but how they push back in managing narratives and changing diversionary tactics and all the rest of it. But I suppose if you want to talk about it in reality, it's been pointed out that the fossil fuel subsidies that are paid out every year globally, if you combine them, I think it's 2 years of amount would be what's the estimated amount to tackle the 1.5% climate, you know, 1.5 degrees that we're all fascinated about. I mean, the money, the means, but it would mean then giving up a certain economic model, John. It would mean being honest with people about, as you said, our you know, we send for every dollar we send to the developing world, we extract 100. We'd have to tell the truth on that, you know. We'd have to call out the World Bank's thing of saying, well, capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 100 years than any other system. And you're going, yeah, but you're still working off of metrics of $2 a day, folks. You know, that was okay in the 1970s when you started with this metric. You've basically allowed for very little inflation on that, you know, $2 a day thing. We'd have to be very honest, and then we'd have to talk about the reality that, like, I know for a fact that there are tech bros buying land in Ireland, buying land in New Zealand, and they're thinking, you know, we're going to make all of these speeches, but if anything, if the worst happens, you know, I'll own most of West Cork, so who gives a shit, really?
Yeah, I am 100% sure that is the mentality of a lot of people at the top of world society, that they're going to be okay. But of course, as we see in Don't Look Up, like, one of the most beautiful aspects of it, the most satisfying laughs is at the very end, like the people who escape on the spaceship and then get themselves, like, directly personally eaten. I thought that was the the greatest imaginable way to end the movie. And it was the biggest laugh, like, in the theater when I was there seeing it.
Yeah, there's no fun in escaping if it's just yourselves. There's just no fun. And I mean, it is. And the concept is great, because that is what they're looking for, some pod or bubble somewhere on the surface of the planet where they're, if not immune, at least insulated from all the rest of the chaos around them. But it's also, there's a dichotomy exists in all narratives at the moment. We'll read articles about what are jobs in the future? What does a job in the future look like? And if we're to be really honest about it, maybe scavenging is going to be, you know, just...
Why aren't they teaching children how to scavenge in schools? Anymore? Like, these are the skills of the future.
You know, how to take an electric engine rusted.
Coding's not doing anything for me. I need to...
No, like, why don't we have scavenger dojo?
Oh God. I want to go back to, now again, it's not, John, you are friends of one of the writers, David Sirota, and I've butchered his name. But it was an interesting reaction to even the writers I've seen. And I'd like to go back to the film if we could, but I do think, you know, the idea, even the fact that they managed to get such a stellar cast of, you know, like, huge cast to do this, maybe maybe there's hope in the message of that alone, where enough people do, you know, said, yeah, I'll do this with, not to be bad to the two guys. They're hardly what you'd call huge in terms. It's not like it's, you know, presented by a Michael Bay film and we're going to have Transformers or something. This is very different, you know?
No, it is. It's incredible. Like its popular success is amazing exactly because of that. Like, you know, 9 out of 10 big movies in America now are sequels or superhero movies, something like that. And this is all 100% like new. Like it's not going to be a ride at a theme park. You know, Disney is not going to have a Don't Look Up ride. There's no merchandising. Like they're not going to be little dolls of all the characters. So it is very different from most big movies with big stars now. And that's fantastic for the future of, like, I wrote something about how, you know, it's been kind of ominous that there has been so little imagining of our possible future in popular culture, because people kind of need to imagine, you know, what may happen in the future in order to avoid it, to avoid the worst consequences. And that definitely was the case for nuclear war. Like there was a ton of popular culture about nuclear war. I imagine that you yourselves may have been traumatized by some of it.
Oh, I was. I grew up in that. I've been ready for the end.
What did they deliver, Martin? Iodine tablets, wasn't it? Iodine tablets.
But I remember the movies. What was that? Which Way the Wind Blows? Do you remember that one, John?
Yeah. Yes, I absolutely remember that. And boy, that is.
Oh, it's real.
That,
oh my
that
god,
that got to me. As a kid, for sure.
It's vivid, and it's a long, long time since I've seen it, but it's still vivid.
Was the day after shown in Ireland?
Yes, it was. I don't think it was shown twice, but it was certainly shown once because I saw it, and it was, oh my god, it was unreal. That last scene where he's in the pit of what used to be his home, oh my god, it was unreal.
Years after it was broadcast there, I believe I saw Threads, also really something else. And
do you think that we may actually have some form of climate dystopian movement that's done through the arts and culture that maybe changes some hearts and minds, if I can use that awful phrase as well. I'm going to get a slap off Martin for using hearts and minds. Sorry.
I hope so. Like, I hope that this opens the door for other artistic ways of helping people to imagine the destination towards which we're headed, because we really need that. And with nuclear war, it had a sort of a virtuous circle where there was culture about this, and that got people thinking more about it, and thereby got more people politically engaged in the anti-nuclear movement in the 1980s. And that in turn created a larger audience for popular culture around this. The other things, you know, like, there's the movie War Games starring Matthew Broderick.
Yes,
you remember that?
Yes.
Like a great movie.
Yeah.
Very scary. Also very entertaining. The song 99 Luftballons.
Yeah. Yes.
And
I prefer the punk version of it, but nonetheless,
I did not know there was a punk version. I assume that's on YouTube somewhere.
And there is still a culture of. I suppose forewarning, foretelling about nuclear weapons. It still exists. It has never gone away. It's smaller. It just other threats have come to the fore as well, John.
Yeah, and we definitely need more actually about nuclear war now than we're getting. But the point is just that, like, you get the larger number of people involved in political activism, that creates a larger audience for culture about it. That, you know, creates more culture. So it works very well as a phenomenon if you can get the snowball rolling. And so hopefully this is that snowball.
Yeah, I think it could be. I think it could be the snowball. And I think the cast goes on. We have to mention Glenn Close. I mean, God almighty, she was brilliant.
Wait, who are we mentioning?
Oh, sorry, the president. Who did I say?
Oh, Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
You're no American.
Oh yeah, my God.
Meryl Streep.
We don't mix up movie stars here in the United States of America.
But she was, I thought, the perfect amalgam of Clinton and Trump. I thought that was perfectly where she was. She was just fabulous. Utterly fabulous.
She was outstanding. And I will tell you that I was able to see this like at a screening in New York that was followed by a panel with the stars of the movie.
Yeah. Oh, very nice.
And it was a real high point of my movie going experience, I will say.
He's dropping names, folks. Let it go.
Oh, no. It's lovely. That must have been really great. Did you get out to ask any questions or make any comments, John?
I didn't, but the reason I bring it up is that Meryl Streep turns out to be one of the funniest and most charming human beings you've ever encountered, like even off screen. Yeah. And there's a moment in the movie you may remember where, you know, Ariana Grande plays, you know, like a young singer, and she's in the green room with the Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence characters.
Yes, I remember it. Yes.
At one point, the Leonardo DiCaprio character says something to her, and she's like, "Well, like, why don't you mind your own business, you old fuck?"
That was brilliant.
And the person who's the moderator of the panel said to Leonardo DiCaprio, "Like, I think this marks the first time that on screen you've been referred to as old." and Meryl Streep jumped in and said, "That Ariana Grande.
Yeah. Yes, you know, I love that. I love that because we could also talk about Leonardo DiCaprio getting told by some young person to fuck off in other realms. But I don't know what his reach is like. Sorry.
But just to finish this out, John, you know, it the picture it paints of the future is not rosy. But is the hope here that it does stimulate the arts to stimulate politics to actually get on board and do something?
Yeah, it is. And like, if there is some hope in here, it is that. And it's also, you know, I think that something that I try to keep in mind really is that we did a podcast at The Intercept with Naomi Klein, and a point that she makes that I think is very important to keep in mind is that people in their 20s now, like even teenagers who are more politically informed and active, like have a completely different mindset than we may have, in that they have been so brutalized, like they really do feel that they have nothing left to lose. And they're probably right. Like the system does not work for them. Like in small ways, student debt, mm-hmm. like, and in very big ways, like the fact that we've ruined the planet and are about to hand it off to them. And so like young people are much more willing to go as far as needs to be gone on this issue. Like they're ready. And if they can be mobilized, they will be like an extremely powerful force. And there are already signs of that happening, I think. So that is something to be optimistic about. And hopefully this movie will contribute to that.
I am, if I can just come in on that before we wrap on this, it's actually, we had Naomi on as well, Naomi Klein.
I knew you'd say that. I was waiting for you to say that.
But if you recall, Martin, the biggest reaction we had was because she was critical of the climate. I'm using the word critical. Don't start adding Naomi Klein on Twitter, folks. Of movements like Extinction Rebellion, and how if they don't include working class people, because it's also a class struggle, John. And I think that is what when you say young people, we understand that they're dispossessed, their jobs are precarious, their employment terms are worse, their rents are high. There's, you know, that we have problems here with security of tenure and housing. So if we make climate, as we sadly seem to be on a global scale, like we're talking about, everybody has to borrow 50 grand of a green loan to retrofit their homes to do climate action instead of the state doing something. And I do think that is the main obstacle, the main hurdle we have to clear. And it's up to actually, okay, yes, it's up to young people, but it's also up to older lads like ourselves to say, no, lads, we can't ask them to put up with less than we had. And maybe we do need to, as we say, send down the ladder as opposed to pull it up after ourselves. Rant out of the way, but I do think there's a, no, I do think class is such an important issue when it comes to climate action.
Yeah, that is absolutely 100% the case and has to be at the forefront of any discussion about this, any talking about this, because, you know, the last 30 years, maybe the last 50 years have just seen life for regular people growing worse and worse and worse and worse. All the money has been siphoned up to the top, and the money to solve climate change has to come from the top. Like that burden cannot be put on the shoulders of people lower down the class scale, for sure. They, like anybody lower down the class scale who hears that is going to reject it, and rightfully so.
I think just to finish this off, maybe there's a way of addressing what Tony was saying there, and it's in the movie. And it's, in, you know, it's just green transition. So maybe we should pronounce the title, Just Look Up. John Schwartz, thanks very much for coming along and having this chat with us. As always, a pleasure to have a chat with you.
Yes, it was great talking to you guys. Thanks very much.
John, thanks very much. Folks, we'll be back to you during the week. As I said, coming up on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and myself and Martin will be traveling. Speaking of a guy who said the same thing over and over and over and over again, and eventually got listened to until they turfed him out, Jeremy Corbyn is giving the key address, and we're hoping to doorstep him at some stage. So we'll see how lucky we are. If there's a picture of me in a newspaper being escorted away, it's because I tried to get close to Jeremy Corbyn to get him to do the bloody podcast. We will talk to you all very soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.